is what I'm after. What frame of mind does a competitor need to succeed at the highest level of this sport? I call up Jim Bauman, a sports psychologist who worked with the U.S. Olympic swim team over four Olympic cycles, from 2004 to 2016, for a peek inside the elite swimming brain. A lot of sports psychologists describe swimming as 90% mental, but in a way Bauman thinks it's the opposite. They talk about mindfulness, but I think of it more like mindlessness, he explains. His job, as he sees it, is to make that mental piece smaller and smaller and smaller, so that when it's time for the swimmers to race, the 767 is on autopilot. They're controlled by their biomechanics and their race plan, not their emotions or worries. The mental and emotional baggage is, as the flight attendants say, safely stowed away. Every day, day after day, in the same pool, you can see people in the next lane, but you can't really talk to them. Back and forth, staring down at the black line at the bottom of the pool. It's a lot of time to think, and if you aren't careful, fear can take over. Among elite swimmers, that line is a menace, a thing you can grow to hate. You show up on competition day and ask yourself, was all of that worth it? Even if you're successful, Bauman says, the cavernous space of your head amplifies the ego and the self-talk and makes it all echo. The best swimmer in the world at the moment, Katie Ledecky, may have a special knack for clearing her head. Fear is a major issue for most athletes, but Bauman thinks she's wired differently. Ledecky currently holds the world record in the 400, 800, and 1500-meter freestyle. At the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, she obliterated her own world records in the 400-meter and 800-meter freestyle races by jaw-dropping margins. In 2018, she beat her 1500-meter record by 5 seconds. By the time she was 21 years old, she had set 14 world records. By the time you listen to this, she may have added even more. If you listen to Ledecky talk about swimming, you begin to realize how single-minded her focus is. Years ago, as a 15-year-old upstart preparing for her first international meet, the 2012 London Olympics, she visualized her race. She never visualized winning anything but gold. She was the youngest on that Olympic team, racing against the reigning champion in that champion's home pool. Ledecky's coach for 4 years, Bruce Gemmel, tells me by phone from Maryland, where he coaches the nation's Capital Swim Club. That's where he trained Ledecky after London and up through the Rio Olympics. When asked if she was nervous, she said she never let herself picture anything else but winning. He has a favorite way to describe Ledecky's mindset in competition. She's not afraid of failure, he says, but failure is never an option. On a day-to-day level in practice, as they prepared for Rio, Gemmel says she failed spectacularly, and that, too, was key. She was always willing to stick her neck out in training, and she failed more than anyone else I've ever coached, but that's only because we set the bar so high, he explains. She reached for it. And even if she didn't achieve the times on the sets, or if she faltered and faded, she succeeded in the attempts. And she came back the next day and did it again. As an undergraduate at Stanford University, Ledecky is now a psychology major. For one course, How Beliefs Create Reality, she was asked to talk about how she had used goal setting and mental imagery to win her gold medals. In one PowerPoint presentation, she talked about Gemmel and explained how failure is a critical stepping stone for success, and how not being afraid to fail helped her believe that she could accomplish the goals she set. Gemmel tells me that, in competition, Ledecky has a specific kind of confidence. It's not an arrogance. Michael Phelps took that same confidence into competition, he says, and yet at the same time, in the prep, Katie would be obsessed with any detail or major thing that she could in practice to get better. Bauman, the sports psychologist, has worked with Navy SEALs for years. He has even taken Olympic athletes to do obstacle course training sessions with them in California. People always ask me how Navy SEALs are able to maintain focus in such crazy situations when so many things can be coming at you, he says. What SEALs are good at is being able to find what is relevant in a situation, and they don't get distracted by all the irrelevant stuff, the noise. They focus on the job, the objective, and that's it. Irrelevant stuff for a swimmer. What lane did I get? Who's swimming next to me? Who's in the crowd? Where's the clock? What did social media say about me? What's the temperature of the water? That has nothing to do with your job as a swimmer, Bauman says. In training, you focus on biomechanics, your start, your kick, your breathing and rhythm. He tries to teach his swimmers to do the same thing in a race. Your job is to swim as fast as possible from point A to point B. What your competitor is doing is irrelevant to what you need to do. And that's the way the Navy SEALs think. Athletes who can perform on demand, Torres, Phelps, Ledecky, are enough like SEALs that this was Bauman's mantra for the American swimmers in Rio in 2016. Swim like a dolphin, think like a SEAL. Clearly, the stakes are much different between elite athletes and special operations warfighters, he tells me. But the thinking is similar. In the pool, Ledecky has been described as an assassin, stone cold, pitiless. When it comes to the best minds for swimming, I suppose it shouldn't be surprising that the most elite competitive swimmers share traits with the most elite fighters. What sets Torres, Ledecky, and Phelps apart as successes includes the ability to grind it out, forever and ever, in the interest of achieving autopilot, the mindlessness that Bauman describes. The constant rehearsal and the unwavering focus that's required is its own kind of endurance. Phelps, the winningest Olympian of them all, did plenty of mental rehearsals for his Olympic victories. What a race looks like, feels like, smells like, what you want to happen in that race in the form of a vivid script and images, what distractions may come and how to manage them. He visualized staying in his lane. Stay in your lane meant stop worrying about what everyone else was doing. His longtime coach, Bob Bauman, told him not to say the word can't. Bauman did that, Phelps said recently, so I could broaden my mind and believe that I could do whatever I wanted to. That, he thinks, was key to their success together. But I can't help but point out that hyperfocus is hard to sustain over decades of swimming. Water erodes even the hardest rocks over time. At the elite level, a swimmer is in the pool twice a day, logging 6 to 12 miles a session with precious few days off. It is a punishing regimen to sustain. The clock ticks. Lap after lap, the unchanging scenery. Over the years, even the steel-willed champion who ended up with 28 Olympic medals broke down. The black line bedeviled him. In the chase for those medals, Phelps battled suicidal thoughts and depression. Competitive swimming is lonely. As time went on, the pool contracted, becoming a fishbowl he couldn't escape. We can't really get inside the heads of elite swimmers, of course. We only know what they tell us. Like Torres, Phelps had temporary retirements. He became vocal about depression and mental health. He ended up in rehab in 2014 to deal with his substance abuse. In recovery, he tried to understand how the constant churn of competition wore him down and how he had questioned his own value as a person apart from the swimmer who won medals. He remembered that he loved to swim, that he still wanted to do it. But he realized that his personal objectives had shifted from being a competitive swimmer first to being a husband and father first. Post-rehab, in the lead-up to Rio, where he would win 6 medals, 5 of them gold, he spent most of his training time in an outdoor pool, which was new to him. For the first time, there was something else to look at. You have a different energy outside, Phelps told Sports Illustrated. You finish swimming and look up, and it's a blue sky with no clouds? That's pretty amazing to me. An unofficial survey of popular swim team names, their native animal traits, and where they are found in the United States. Barracudas. Normally distributed widely in temperate, tropical seas, noted for large teeth, vicious behavior, and indiscriminate killing. Swim team sightings in California, Florida, Maryland. Crocodiles. Native to every continent except Antarctica and Europe. Certain species have loud roars and powerful tails excellent for swimming. Significant swim team populations located in California, Indiana, Florida, and Texas. Hammerheads. Found in all tropical waters worldwide, male and female great hammerheads are both solitary and dangerous to humans, while scalloped hammerhead females tend to congregate in large schools. Swim teams widely distributed from New Jersey, Maryland, and Georgia to California and Oregon. Orcas. Found in all oceans of the world, from the Arctic to the Antarctic, they are highly social, and whales in a pod swim together and coordinate their activities, including teaching younger pod members how to hunt and how to be good parents. Swim team populations have similarly wide-ranging communities, including locations in Georgia, Illinois, and Texas. Sea otters. Populating offshore kelp forests along the Pacific coasts of Russia, the Aleutian Islands, Canada, Alaska, Oregon, and California, can swim up to 9 kilometers an hour underwater and are superb divers. Heavy overlap in swim team distribution, especially in California, but ranging to places including Wisconsin. Terrapins. Mostly used to refer to the diamondback terrapin, a species of turtle that lives along the eastern coast of the United States and is also abundant in the Gulf Coast. They spend roughly equal time on land and in brackish, swampy water, though they need fresh water to drink. They are quick to flee and are very good swimmers. Swim teams prevalent in California, Texas, New York, and Maryland. What's a team mascot anyway, but a spirit animal for that team? In these zoological naming conventions, we can read our ambitions as a species. We wish to be native swimmers and merciless competitors. In the wild, speed, power, endurance, and cunning are prized, critical to an animal's success. And so it is in the pool. 13. Sharks and minnows. From where I live in Northern California, it's less than 2 miles to the Albany Aquatic Center, where starting around 4 in the afternoon, you can observe the life cycle of a young swimmer. In the indoor pool, where the warm water serves as an incubator, the youngest children get in first, their squishy, unmuscled limbs moving in whatever the opposite of coordination is, a sort of octopus-like profusion, confusion of arms and legs churning up foamy water as they convey themselves from the edge of the pool to its middle depths. Sometimes their forward progress slows to such a point that it appears that maybe, just maybe, they are moving backward, through some improbable loophole in the laws of physics. These are the tadpoles and the seahorses, or so they are called by their swimming instructor, a chirpy, bespectacled young woman who, despite the uniformity and distortion that latex swim caps and tinted goggles impose on the tiny faces of her students, somehow knows the names of every single one of them. 30 minutes in, the alligators and crocodiles enter the water, followed by the sea turtles and dolphins. I love the names of these groups. They indicate a ruthlessness on the one hand and a sweetly aspirational quality on the other. But somehow they all feel true. The older swimmers are learning backstroke. They attempt elementary dives in the deep end. They perform the underwater undulations that begin to approximate a recognizable dolphin kick. An hour in, the thoroughbreds arrive. Here are the high school swimmers, broad-shouldered Aphrodites and Adonises, all with their unmarred, smoothly muscled physiques, their sturdy bodies as yet to be marked in any obvious way by life. This is what a swim team looks like, or at least the one here in Northern California. The boys wear Speedo briefs or body-hugging knee-length trunks. The girls have strappy one- and two-piece suits in all manner of color and coverage. They move confidently, in great loping strides, without the self-consciousness so common in kids their age, past the steamy heat of the indoor pool and into the bracing open air of the outdoor pool deck. They get in the water, and they are of the water. They are creatures who belong there. They glide and ripple and move in harmony. They work, but it doesn't look like work. It can take a long time to see if someone is going to be a good swimmer, to the tune of years, really. Press rewind on every Olympic swimmer, Katie Ledecky too, and each starts out as one of those squishy little swimmers. There's home video evidence of Ledecky as a 6-year-old churning away in the pool in her first race, periodically popping her head up and craning around to seek out visuals of her competitors. The final lunge for the wall, then her beaming face afterward. "What were you thinking about in the pool?" she's asked. "Nothing," she exclaims, cheerily crooked teeth everywhere. "Just trying hard." Many of us have joined a swim team at one time or another, and there is a shared foundational experience here that's worth examining. Battle past the desperate life-or-death phase of swimming, and you begin to appreciate how good the water feels. Join a team, and you begin to appreciate the company you keep. Competition happens when you get good enough at swimming to want to be better. Right from the start, it becomes about speed and technique. You work to refine your strokes over and over again to achieve what? The win, yes, but that's fleeting, especially at this stage. Parse out the win for even the youngest swimmers and you realize it's the rare coming together of effort and timing that lifts you for days. That's a feeling that any swim team swimmer knows, no matter their level. Even now, I can trace a certain kind of physical confidence that I have all the way back to swim team. I am not a big person, 5'5" on the days I remember to stand up straight. But the water is the one place I feel powerful. I still have in my possession a sheaf of pen and crayon drawings, carefully stapled together and dated July 4, 1984. In those pages, from when I was 6 years old, I stand on the diving board, glorious in stripes, before springing boldly into the air. There were so many ways to enter the water and swim for the ladder. Forward dive, back dive, cannonball, can opener, pencil drop. I documented them all. It was summer. I loved swimming. That was the short of it. The pictures show a joy and a practiced ease. But the operative word here is practiced. If you could peek at the pages between those pages, you would find a dense backstory. I could be free and confident and strong in the water because I'd already spent hundreds of hours learning how to swim. We learned front floats and back floats, the calm suspension of our bodies in water. We learned to hold our breath and kick our feet, the foundation rhythms of propulsion. We learned elementary backstroke, up, out, together, and side stroke, pick up the apple and put it in the basket, the essential strokes of rest. We learned freestyle and how to breathe with our faces to the side, the drive of forward momentum. We learned breaststroke and how to breathe with our heads up, the safe sighting of a destination. All of this was drilled into us by repetition, every summer weekday from 9 to 10:30 in the morning. We put in the effort then to be effortless. Our swim team was the Freeport Sea Devils. I loved all the different ways of getting faster, bobbing along with pole buoys, learning how to soar off the starting blocks, kicking until your legs burned. Most of the time, the payoff wasn't clear right away. My brother and cousins and I played games with the big kids, sharks and minnows, water polo, Marco Polo, hook and ladder, in which one partner would hold on to the other's legs to form a single Frankenswimmer, one person kicking, the other pulling, inevitably resulting in a comically jerky push-pull action from one end of the pool to the other. We swam year-round. In the summer, morning practices were held in the Olympic-size outdoor pool, after which Andy and I would come home and watch cartoons. In the winter, when practices were held indoors after school and ran late into the evenings, my hair would freeze on the car ride home. We had pasta parties before big meets to carbo-load our hungry, growing bodies. Aluminum foil trays of lasagna, spaghetti and meatballs, baked ziti, made lovingly by team parents. Year after year at the division championships, we came in second to Echo Park, our rival team. One year, our coach made a deal with us. If we went undefeated in the season and beat Echo Park at the championship meet, we could shave his head. That year, we won. We threw him into the pool and shaved his curly brown locks at the celebration party afterward. There's a photo from that night, our whole swim team swarming the pool deck. Little kids up front, arms raised in ecstasy. Older kids cheering while perched up and down the ladders to the diving boards. There I am, sitting on the 3-meter high dive, helping to unfurl Freeport's bright red, white, and black team banner in victory. The soundtrack to practice was the swishing echo chamber of the indoor pool deck, muffled in the water, the yelled instructions that only became clearly audible when we lifted our heads up to breathe, or when we reached the wall at the end of a grueling set. Chlorine became my skin's default scent. During the high school season, I walked into homeroom after pre-dawn practice with goggle marks fading from around my eyes. To my classmates, it was the only evidence of my swimming life, other than the occasional swim meet results that came filtered through the garbled fuzz of morning announcements. I end up joining a swim team again around the same time my own 6-year-old does. I spent a decade of my childhood competing, but it's the first time in more than 2 decades that I've trained and raced with others in practice. As an adult, I want to remember what it was all for. At the point of this comeback, I've just turned 40. So I guess I aspire to be an everywoman Dara Torres. My team is the Albany Armada. Felix's is the Berkeley Barracudas. The Armada is a master's team, which means that it's part of U.S. Masters Swimming, the competitive swim team circuit for swimmers 18 and up. Established in 1970, U.S. Masters now has 65,000 members around the country and 1,500 teams and training groups, and it sanctions regional, national, and international meets. It doesn't matter if you're a 22-year-old water rocket just off a college team or a novice swimmer over 80, there's a spot for you. Some swimmers compete in meets, while others prioritize training as its own goal. The head coach of the Albany Armada, Carol Knipp, is a sun-burnished woman in her early 60s who wears bright red lipstick and a big smile. Though I'd been swimming at the Albany pool for 4 years, I'd never swum with the Masters team. It wasn't for a lack of Coach Carol's recruiting efforts. I see why she has won national awards for superlative coaching and community building. I just wasn't sure I was ready for someone to tell me what to do in the pool again. I'd spent the last 20 years focusing on how to swim for fun and exercise, to swim an hour-long workout without worrying too much about speed and without the stress of competition. Master swimming intimidated me. On our respective first days of practice, Felix and I both feel the same nervous butterflies quivering in our stomachs. Those time-worn social anxieties. Will it be fun? Will I be able to keep up? Will everyone be better than me? Are streaming on loop. As I walk out on the pool deck, I'm startled by the momentary feeling that I'm walking with a shadow of my girlhood self. When I was a child, competition was a way to assert integrity and dominance and power where perhaps there was none. I can see that there's something warlike in this, and as much as I've ever cultivated conflict, this is the arena. But along with that adrenaline rush comes a fear of putting myself out there, in public, against the clock, against other swimmers. I don't want to care what other people think, but I do. When I look back on it, there was a kind of paradise lost moment in my early swimming life, when I first understood how competition could get you down. I was an 8th grader on the varsity team, swimming in my first big championship final. It was the evening of the annual high school county meet, and I was surprised and delighted to find myself in the final heat of the 100-yard breaststroke. There was an older girl I looked up to, a senior. We swam on the same club circuit. I equated her in my mind with goddess. I was a long-shot contender in the outside lane. She had the fastest qualifying time and got that favored middle placement in lane 4. In the moments before the race, she came up to me behind the starting blocks. I smiled excitedly, happy to see her. But the smile quickly dropped off my face when I saw the look on hers. She had a sick-to-your-stomach anxiety that was, I now know, contagious. "I'm so nervous," she said, clutching my arm. This was not the girl I knew, who was always smiling and kind, but also projected a cool confidence. This was someone else, a someone who was desperately holding on to me like I was her life raft. This is my last race in high school. And then she said something that startled me. Please don't beat me. We went on to swim the race, and she ended up winning after all. After the race, she hugged me, back to her usual effervescent self as she went to celebrate with her teammates. I'm pretty sure I did try to win, although I can't say that her words didn't change me somehow. Something crept in that day. An understanding that when you become accustomed to winning, you become afraid of losing. Competition was not a totally happy thing, not even for an eighth grader, and the worry of it could drag down the free-flying feeling I'd come to associate with it. At practice with the Armada, I look at all of us in the water, flitting back and forth across the pool in our flashy, colorful suits. One thing that hasn't changed is that Speedos are still as gaudy as they ever were, and I see a school of flashing fish. After just a few weeks, I realized that I'd missed training with a team, the motivation of swimming together. I find that it's easier to make myself swim fast for someone else. Having teammates picks you up and pushes you along. In that school of fish, there's a shared consciousness and a shared purpose. I go home after a particularly grueling midday practice, and when I rise from my desk, my left shoulder complains. Or else it's my right. Some days, I give age a concession and take an afternoon nap. One morning, Coach Carroll hands each of us a little notebook. Before she lets us get in the water, she makes us scribble down two goals for the next year. What do I write? 1. Do something that scares me. 2. Swim in a meet for the first time in 20-plus years? Later, after practice, Coach Carroll stops me outside the pool. The Pacific Masters Short Course Championships is coming up, she says cheerfully. I think you can be really competitive in your age group. Mark it on your calendar. At these words, my adrenaline spikes, a Pavlovian response I thought I'd outgrown. But I'm curious about competing again. I find myself thinking back on those Sea Devil days. Who was that girl who once thrilled at a race? And what version of my competitive self would show up at the meet? Competition day glints like an outdoor pool, all dewy, blue, and sunshine. On the early morning drive over the Berkeley Hills to the Soda Aquatic Center, I feel my stomach turning over. My left shoulder is still a little cranky from when I surfed 2 days ago, just enough to remind me of my 40 to 44 age group. To offset the anxiety, I decided to swim two fast, fun events, the 50-meter breaststroke and the 100 IM, or individual medley. 25 yards each of butterfly, backstroke, breaststroke, and freestyle. The pool at the Soda Aquatic Center is a thing of beauty. 18 competition lanes that allow two heats to run concurrently with 9 lanes each. The pool is so big that there are 2 extra lanes in between, left empty as a buffer. A thin, translucent layer of fog hovers above the cerulean water, waiting to be burned off by a still sleepy sun. Off to the left, behind a set of metal bleachers and a digital timing board, there's also a dedicated warm-up pool, open for use between races so we can stay loose. Hundreds of swimmers are milling about, swathed in the shin-length hooded parkas that are particular to swim teams, bulky, fleece-lined nylon monstrosities in all colors, heavy on the reds and blacks and royal blues, trimmed with gold and black and white, embroidered with inscrutable acronyms. MEMO, TOC, EBAT, ALB. I know that last one, at least, because it's us, Albany Armada. I still remember what to do. I shed my layers in a heap under our team's shade tent and snap on my cap and goggles, being careful not to poke a fingernail through the delicate yellow and navy latex of our team cap. After warm-ups, Coach Carroll hands me a rubber band, a reminder to always be flexible. She also presses a blue ribbon into my hand. You've won already, she says, grinning. It's your first meet since high school. At the lane assignment for my first event, the 50-yard breaststroke, I take a long look around. I can't help noticing a swimmer in the 80 to 84 age group standing nearby, wearing a black cap, a red team parka, and matching bright lipstick, a serene look on her beautifully made-up face. I look at her, and something about her contented presence settles me. The official calls my heat, and I step up to the starting blocks, at the precipice of that gorgeous, glorious, ginormous pool. Swimmers, take your mark. At the signal, I take the plunge. The rush of the water in my ears, a froom like the ocean. That delicious silence underwater, strong pull, kick, glide. The fragment of time is so full of possibility, I almost don't want to break the surface. When I do, I don't hear anything. Arms and legs are moving mechanically now, executing the breaststroke they've been practicing so faithfully. And yet my mind is moving a beat behind, not quite there with my body. It isn't until the second lap of the two-lap race that I wake up, suddenly and with startling clarity, and everything clicks into focus. The last 15 yards, a surging in my limbs, as if I've just remembered to hit the gas pedal. Afterward, when I'm not cheering for my teammates, I drift around the pool deck with a foolish grin on my face. I still have another race, and the results won't come in until hours later. I place third in both of my events. I'm no Olympic swimmer. My goals are modest. The stakes are low. But however fleeting it is, I remember what it feels like. A momentary lightness, the feeling of having done my ever-elusive best. In practice, Coach Carroll offers constant calibrations. Keep your head between your arms on the breaststroke. Press. Your head is popping straight up and it's stopping your forward movement. Your right arm keeps crossing over on backstroke. Try reaching for 3 o'clock. Keep your hands apart when you enter on the butterfly pole. Out here, shoulder width apart, not together. On freestyle, lengthen your right arm, elbow high. You are entering short. I keep these in mind as I swim on my own outside of practice. Press, reach, head down, fingertips dragging. It's a constant refinement, and I begin to realize that the physical repetition can be a kind of meditation that transcends the simple goal of winning a race. I've never really thought about swimming in this way, since the frenzy of head-to-head competition always eclipsed it. Still does. Even at 40, there's nothing like the impending anxiety of a race to send me straight to the bathroom. But there is a Zen practice to be found here, in the motions, in the pool, in the Karate Kid wax on, wax off repetition until it's right. It is swimming as self-improvement. We practice starts, turns, streamlines. We get up on the blocks and rehearse relays. As I become more and more immersed in this kind of intent practice, I think about what intrigues me about swimming as a sport. That the adversary is not actually the other person, though that other person is there, swimming alongside you. What I mean by this is that swimming competition is not like fencing or wrestling, where you outwit the other person. Like running, swimming has a basic, elemental feel. Your chief adversary is the clock. And in this case, the water that you've got to work with to beat it. 14. Ways of the Samurai. Picture a silent samurai, submerged to his shoulders in water, swimming across a river with speed and efficiency, all while wearing a full 45-pound suit of armor. In Japan, a country of islands, writings dating back hundreds of years describe samurai swimming. In feudal times, different ryu, or schools of swimming, developed. Samurai protecting each region and geography had their own ways of navigating the local waters with artful efficiency. Nearly every clan had a ryu during the feudal period, from 1603 to 1868. When swimming as a military art blossomed under the encouragement of the Tokugawa shogunate. The schools of different warrior groups came up with a diverse array of techniques for sneaking up on an enemy, floating for long periods, and fording fierce rivers. These classical Japanese swimming martial arts, or Niha-Niho, evolved to prize grace and elegance, with deliberate movements that reflected conditions such as ripples and waves, so that the body and the water could move harmoniously as one. In 1898, Japan hosted its first modern swim competition in the port city of Yokohama, one of the first parts of the country to be opened up to trade with the rest of the world. Yokohama, understandably, was the site of many foreign firsts for this once-isolated nation. The first English-language newspaper, the Japan Herald, the country's first and largest Chinatown, and this first international swim meet between Japan and a combined team that included England, Australia, and the United States. Using centuries-old samurai swimming strokes, the Japanese beat the foreigners in the 100-yard and 440-yard races. It's a challenge to find any English-language record of this historic sporting event, but I tracked down a 1935 book about the history of swimming in Japan. In it, I found a reference to the mysterious Englishman named Arbin, who managed to win the third event, the 880-yard race. Why those particular distances were selected for the races, I cannot tell you. But I can tell you that the Yokohama contest holds a special place in Japanese swimming history. More than a mere swim meet, it symbolized a larger head-to-head measuring up of Eastern and Western traditions and philosophies. In the meet, the English used the trudgeon. Imagine a head-up alternating front arm stroke, but with a kind of sideways leg thrash with each stroke. The Brit John Arthur Trudgeon picked it up from the indigenous tribes as a boy growing up in Brazil and debuted the stroke in England in 1873. 2 years later, he won a local competition using it in a record-breaking time. The trudgeon was hailed as a breakthrough. But the Japanese had their own version of an overarm side stroke that was incredibly fast for the time. Their victories showed that swimmers using Niha-Niho, one of the 18 martial arts of the samurai warrior class, including horsemanship, archery, fencing, and hand-to-hand combat, could compete and win against swimmers using Western techniques. The competition had an undercurrent of nationalist pride that coincided with the Meiji period and the modernization and unification of Japan. In the early 20th century, Japan began sending more swimmers to international swimming contests. During this period, strokes in the West were rapidly developing, and the Japanese worked hard to catch up. They adopted the latest versions of the front crawl stroke, being employed by their competitors, and studied techniques from books that they imported from England and America. One modern pool was built in Osaka, at a middle school, and students there were taught the crawl stroke. It was at this middle school that a young man named Katsuo Takaishi began to swim competitively. In 1924, in Paris, he became the first Japanese swimmer to garner attention at the Olympics, managing fifth-place finishes in the 100-meter and 1500-meter freestyle races, and a fourth-place finish in the 800-meter relay with three of his teammates. It was a rallying cry. The next year, all the disparate swimming groups in Japan were united under a formal amateur swimming federation. Takaishi became Japan's freestyle swimming champion. In 1926, he and others were invited to meet in Hawaii, where America's best swimmers were waiting to race them. There, Takaishi thrilled his countrymen by shattering Johnny Weissmuller's Olympic records in the 50-meter and 400-meter freestyle events. This was a big deal. At the time, Weissmuller was the famously handsome face of American swimming and one of the world's fastest swimmers, having just won two gold medals in the Paris Olympics, beating out the legendary Hawaiian swimmer and surfer Duke Kahanamoku. 4 years earlier, Weissmuller had been the first to break the one-minute barrier in the 100-meter freestyle, that he would later go on to play Tarzan in MGM's blockbuster films and become an international movie star of the era is also worthy of note. What about the other strokes? During the same period, Yoshiyuki Tsuruta became Japan's dominant breaststroker, At the 1928 Amsterdam Olympics, he became the first Japanese swimmer ever to win gold in the 200-meter breaststroke. He was vocal about the influence of the classical Japanese swimming martial arts on breaststroke as we know it. He described it as a speeded-up form of hira oyogi, a stroke developed by the Kankai Ryu that was especially intended for swimming in the open sea over long distances. He saw value in the long tradition of Japanese training techniques in breaststroke and the skills it took to swim it well. It was at the 1932 Los Angeles Olympics that Japan's champions finally broke out on the world stage with extraordinary dominance. With Takaishi as captain and also part of the coaching staff, and Tsuruta leading the breaststroke contingent, the team swimmers dazzled with their fitness and speed. They took home a total of 12 medals, more than a third of all the swimming medals that were handed out. They won gold in 5 of the 6 men's swimming events, sweeping the medal podium in the 100-meter backstroke and performing near sweeps in 3 other events. Tsuruta won gold again in the 200-meter breaststroke, becoming the first Japanese swimmer to win back-to-back gold medals in the same event. At those games, Tsuruta saw hope for the reinvigoration of breaststroke's popularity and pride in Japanese traditions. With his younger teammate, Hideko Miyata, who won silver in the women's 200-meter breaststroke, she was the first Japanese woman ever to medal in the Olympics. 4 years later, she'd win her gold. With Tsuruta, the Japanese began a reign of dominance in breaststroke that has lasted for nearly a century and produced an extensive cast of Olympic medalists. I like to think that each of the different strokes has its own personality. Breaststroke is often thought of as the slow stroke, but it's my favorite. It requires a raised head breath with every pull. It lacks the overt, churning power of freestyle and backstroke, and the flashy, splashy show that is butterfly. Butterfly, strangely enough, evolved from breaststroke in the 1930s, when practitioners discovered that an out-of-the-water arm pull was faster than an in-the-water arm pull. A variation of the butterfly was used in breaststroke competition until 1952, when it was accepted by FINA as a separate stroke. At the 1956 Olympics, butterfly was finally swum as its own event. Concealed behind breaststroke's deliberate pacing is a quiet strength. It came naturally to my brother, but not to me. As a kid, I worked hard to be good at breaststroke, and by extension, to acquire that quality that I associate with it. I had the propensity to hurry, and still do. But breaststroke won't let you be impatient. If you do, you lose the glide and the entire mechanism for speed that's hidden in the stroke. Rush, and you go slower. It's the paradox of breaststroke. Ease up, though, and you stretch, like taffy. Cut the quick bobs and you're pulled along, effortless, smooth as the hull of a boat cutting through early morning glass on a river. That frog kick, working without splash underneath the surface, is your secret propeller. During practice, I used to draft behind my brother when I felt tired, using his wake to save energy. "Stop dragging off me," he'd say, but he'd smile to soften the words. In a breaststroke race, the pacing is different. You must be thoughtful with timing, not hasty, or you get nowhere. In a modern world that is so obsessed with speed, it's a good reminder of what's possible when we slow down. In an effort to be a better swimmer, I've been tinkering with the mechanics of my strokes with Coach Carroll, lengthening my arms, keeping my head more streamlined, pressing my legs together. I attend my son's practices, where whole tidal waves of little kids churn back and forth across the pool. When Felix emerges from the water at the end of a session, lips blue and skinny shoulders shivering, he reminds me of my brother. I ask Felix how his swimming is coming along, and he informs me that he doesn't like the cold water. "What about racing?" I ask. "I've seen the way he ratchets up the effort if someone inches up alongside him in the lane. Don't you like going fast?" He thinks for a minute. "I don't like it if someone tells me to do it," he says. "I like it if it's my choice." Now he reminds me of me. Self-discipline in the pursuit of self-betterment is hard at any age, especially when you're a child. But I'm older now. I have the feeling that I have something to learn from Japan's swimming martial art about what it means to be better. Patience, for one, but also a longer, meticulously studied view on how our bodies can work in all kinds of water. When I find out that there are samurai swimming competitions being held today in Japan, now picture that, silent samurai gliding across a 25-meter swimming pool that attracts swimmers from as far away as Poland and England, I make the trip to Tokyo to seek out the leading practitioners of Nihaniho. In a Japanese television report, a samurai lowers himself into a swimming pool. I watch closely as he demonstrates kachugozen oyogi, full armor swimming. He moves smoothly on a sideways path across the pool, legs alternately circling. The metal-pronged helmet atop his head stays dry. Despite the blanket of riveted leather scales weighing down his torso, he slides along, wraith-like. "The armor is very heavy," the young man says with a little smile, after he has dragged himself and his waterlogged equipment out of the pool. "But I'm delighted I can swim." The news report, lucky for me, is subtitled in English. Another swimmer, this one dressed in swimming trunks and a black cap with white stripes, demonstrates a different, more dynamic skill. Inatobi, gray mullet jumping. From a still and submerged position, the swimmer surges vertically out of the water, arms whipping back and head thrust forward, exposed to his very lean and very tan waist. It is the fundamental method of jumping while swimming to disentangle oneself from seaweed or other debris, or to leap onto a boat. Finally, the most fundamental of all moves, tachi oyogi, standing swimming. The young competitor's face is relaxed, his eyes trained on the horizon. His head moves near imperceptibly, the water in front of him as still as glass. It's as if he is on a very slow treadmill hidden just below the surface of the water. His head and hair are completely dry. Different schools have different variations, but the basics are the same. That familiar egg-beater kick used today by synchronized swimmers and water polo players to propel their upper bodies so powerfully out of the water. It bears a strong resemblance to the method described in detail in 16th century master scrolls from the Kobori Ryu, which specializes in techniques to free up the hands. The muted cycling of the legs is meant to be efficient and to keep the upper body stationary and stable. The version of the egg-beater kick used by the Japanese synchronized swimming team comes directly from the Nojima Ryu. I learned that if you're good at standing swimming, you can do anything in the water. Write calligraphy, load and fire a rifle, duel with swords. You can carry weapons and flags. You can shoot a bow and arrow with great accuracy while nearly submerged. Remember that the feathers on an arrow need to be dry to fly true. In the news segment, we see two men fight, each gripping his wooden sword with both hands. They shout and circle each other warily as if they are dancing, but they're treading water in a lake far from shore. We see two women swimming mukite, the withdrawing hand style. This high elbow crawling arm technique is used to swim facing the wind and waves or when crossing the tide. It allows you to cut through the waves with your shoulder and avoid being overwhelmed by the foamy force of a breaking wave. Midori Ishibiki is a modern-day master in the age-old art of samurai swimming. Appointed by the Japan Swimming Federation, Midori is one of eight people who are responsible for preserving the swimming martial art of Japan. Like any other martial art, judo, say, or kendo, Nihaniho is governed by various levels of practice, and each level requires years of training and exams to move up to the next. Midori grew up in Tokyo and now lives in Kamakura, a seaside town an hour south of the city. 50 years old, with reddish-brown hair styled in a bob framing her round face, she can glide across a pool with barely a ripple. But Nihaniho isn't just about physical skills. It also emphasizes a spiritual path, she says in her perky British-accented English, which comes from years of living in Norwich. It's like meditation. Old Japanese texts teach that swimming in freezing water cultivates perseverance. Submergence leads to patience. Diving fosters bravery. Floating of the body leads to serenity of the mind. The mastery of rescue and resuscitation is a sign of wholehearted benevolence. Midori began studying classical swimming techniques with her master when she was 13, during summers at the beach in Chiba, across Tokyo Bay from the city of Tokyo. Her club's current master, Kozu Yamaguchi, is now in his mid-80s, and Midori still studies with him every summer. But these days, the student is also a master. And while in Chiba, she in turn instructs more than 200 junior high school students from their school's clubhouse. Theirs is the Suifu Ryu, which devised practical ways to swim efficiently on the open sea and rivers, to safely get through waves, say, or to quickly retrieve something floating nearby. Though samurai swimming is at the roots of Japan's swimming culture, its traditions are waning. But those tasked with its preservation see a direct line to modern Japanese swimming success in international competition. During an unseasonably balmy week in early May, I travel around Tokyo to see what samurai swimming looks like today and what it means that people are still doing it. My pursuit of Midori Ishibiki leads me to an indoor swimming club in Yokohama, where I am sweating profusely on the pool deck. The indoor pool deck is like a sauna turned up to the max. It causes me distress to be dressed in street clothes by the edge of a perfectly nice pool, but it's the only way I can take proper notes on the happenings in Midori swim class. Today there are 5 Hanshi masters, the highest level masters there is in Nihon Iho, attending the class along with the regular students. One of the masters, Masaaki Imamura, the 73-year-old vice chair of the Japan Swimming Federation's Committee on Nihon Iho, is examining me curiously. He also thinks it's weird that I'm wearing street clothes. "Why don't you swim?" He greets me with a deep, booming voice as he issues forth a charming grin. "It is very hot." He is wearing a black Speedo and a black cloth swim cap with white piping and strings that tie under his chin. The black cap indicates seniority in the Shinden Ryu. White caps are given to beginners, much like the white belt in other martial arts like judo or karate. The progression of colors, however, varies by Ryu. I manage to smile back, then grimace, and I'm tempted to dash back into the locker room to shed my heavy cotton dress and leggings so I can get in that water too. But I can't chance missing what happens next. The 15 men and women in Midori's class circle and bow. Then, one by one, they stride to the water and slip in, smoothly and soundlessly, like ducks to the surface of a lake. After a few laps, Imamura hops out and volunteers to be my de facto sports announcer. "Why do we swim?" rumbles Imamura with another winning smile. "Well, that's very simple, you see." Like a professor, he steeples his hands, and then proceeds to tick off the following on his slender brown fingers. For survival. Japan, of course, is surrounded by water. For religion. In Shinto practices, misoji, ritualistic cleaning of the body and mind with water, is sacred. For fighting. The samurai, to protect feudal territory, developed regionally specific swimming schools. For competition. Disciplines include diving and racing, say, or synchronized swimming. For strength of mind and body. The topmost principle in Nihon Iho is mind and water together. The last principle, he says, can be explained as Mizo no Kokoro, or mind like water. On the bench next to us, he traces a finger on its surface with water as he speaks, writing out the Japanese characters. This is the most important thing. There are many reasons, but when you get older, you can appreciate the Zen part. The master part, the philosophy. We pause to observe Midori as she swims by. She wears a black cap with 2 white stripes that signify that she is the director of her group. As the rest of the class watches from the side of the pool, she demonstrates the Nukite style, that withdrawing arm stroke I saw on Japanese television, the one intended to cut through incoming waves as one heads out to sea, Because she does this all with seeming effortlessness and with a smile, her at-homeness in the water makes me think of a friendly porpoise at play. "Midori-san, she is very good," Imamura says approvingly. He comments on her smooth, elegant stroke and emphasizes the power of her propulsion. "You know Kitajima?" he asks, referring to the Japanese breaststroker Kosuke Kitajima, perhaps the greatest breaststroker of all time. Kitajima retired in 2016 after winning double gold in the men's 100 and 200-meter breaststroke in the 2004 Athens and the 2008 Beijing Olympics. Kitajima swims breaststroke like Nihaniho because he has one powerful stroke and then floats, a long, long glide. "The power of that one stroke," he explains, "is critical. It shows a mastery of pacing and patience. You can go very fast using these techniques, but that is not what it is about," Imamura says. Now, in modern Japan, Nihaniho is for older people who know it is not about racing or winning the way it is for young people. We practice, 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 and work very, very hard to get in that place of Zen. It is about strength of mind. Like Midori, Imamura has been a senior figure in Nihaniho circles for decades. He learned Nihaniho as a child in school, first and foremost out of tradition. He continued the martial arts practice because he liked the meditative quality that came along with the physical movements. "It's like Tai Chi, but in water," he says. "That's a good comparison. In the concentration, you find a peace." The class splits into groups of three, and each group sets off swimming across the pool in a triangle formation. Head up, arms alternating in a front crawl stroke, legs frog kicking. Each person is fully aware of the others in the group, making minute adjustments so that the whole group moves in synchrony. "Different swimmers have different strengths and weaknesses according to their bodies," Imamura explains. "The three-swimmer formation is an exercise in awareness of your own body and others, and of the ever-changing environment, too, and control. You can't work against water. You have to work with water," Imamura says. As other longtime coastal cultures, like the Dutch, emphasize here, again, is the idea of water as ally, not enemy. Knowing how to survive water is what allows us to see it as a friend. After class, the masters delight me with an invitation to join them for beers in a small pub across the street from the pool. Midori, Imamura, and I crowd around a wooden table along with another master, Saki Kozuma, a dimpled young woman in her 30s who stood out from the rest of the class by virtue of her radiant youth. Then a trim, bespectacled man with neatly combed gray hair materializes at the corner of the table. Akinori Hino, the head of the National Committee of Nihaniho himself. I recognize him from the Japanese news report I watched about Nihaniho. On this Sunday afternoon, because Midori informed him of my visit, he has taken the trouble to put on a jacket and tie to meet me. With this eminent group of swimming masters gathered, I ask what allure Nihaniho holds today. Why do people take classes in the swimming martial art instead of other swimming lessons? What are they looking for? "It is very fun," Imamura exclaims. Midori laughs. "Nihaniho is to make yourself better," she adds after a moment. "Maybe it's health, or lifestyle, or something for your mind. Every single person is at their own level, and it lets you choose your own purpose in the practice. What is your best purpose? It can be time or speed, but it's not just that. It can also be that I want to be more beautiful in my stroke." Hino nods sagely. "The patience, relaxation, and slowness of it is what I find interesting," he says. He pauses as the proprietress of the pub brings a tray of beers. A round of cheers and kanpai, and then we continue our conversation. Kozuma, the young master, learned to swim in school when she was in kindergarten. School-age swim instruction is mandatory in Japan. She started Nihaniho at her university. "I liked thinking about how to tread water, how to catch water, how to exercise for your mind too, not just for body. She teaches Nihon Iho to high school and college kids at a university swim club in Tokyo. The water is the last place where people cannot text, call, or find me, she says with a giggle. In her efforts to develop the next generation, she finds that Nihon Iho has unexpected benefits. Tony Kundi is a big guy, 6 feet five and over 200 pounds. But when he's in the water practicing Nihon Iho, he's mostly hidden away to chin level. He gets a different view of the world there. Recently, on a trip to London, he swam in Hyde Park, swans and all. When you're in the water, because you're not breaking the water or splashing, dragonflies will flit past you. Boatmen will glide by, he tells me. Your understanding of the world is at the waterline, not underneath. He pauses, considering. Though a swan did attack me once. Kundi is the only non-Japanese person ever to be certified to teach Nihon Iho. He lives in Tokyo and works as a top advertising executive, but he grew up swimming in Plymouth, a prominent English naval town. As a young man, he was proud of being an accomplished and speedy swimmer in the Olympian tradition. He moved to Tokyo in 1995 when he was 22 to study Aikido. 5 years later, he began to learn about Nihon Iho. And everything I thought I knew about swimming, he says, went out the window. He remembers being in the pool with his swimming teacher for the first time, talking to him at length about the swimming martial arts tradition. His sensei was standing in front of him, arms folded, nodding his head. But he wasn't standing on the bottom of the pool. He was standing swimming, tachi oyogi, the Japanese style of treading water. His upper body was so still that Kundi couldn't stop staring. A teacher dropping to the bottom of a 5-meter pool, walking across it, and then floating serenely back up. A practitioner treading water with arms aloft, holding a 5-kilogram dumbbell for more than an hour. His sensei firing arrows across the water to hit the centers of various targets. Suddenly, he saw swimming was not about speed or distance, but about becoming skilled enough to handle whatever water scenarios he might encounter out in the world. He learned to develop movement and momentum in new ways, through the hips and legs, and with much less use of the arms. It was a revelation. My swimming was always head down, thrash away, down, up, how many laps can I do? I never noticed anything else, Kundi says. Now my head is always up, and I breathe through my nose. I can see every wave, and I'm very aware of my surroundings. Speed is just one component of Nihon Iho, not the fundamental objective. For the most part, Kundi sees it as a way to experience his environment more keenly. Kundi has competed in different Nihon Iho events, including the annual national competition in Japan. Only two events in that competition are races, one of which employs the stroke that those Yokohama swimmers used to beat the foreigners way back in 1898. The examinations and competitions range from those time trials and weight holding to demonstrations of flag waving and armored swimming. I ask him, half jokingly, if he feels ready for battle. Crikey, he exclaims, thinking for a moment. Then he points out that some of the principles are similar to the combat and treading techniques used by the Navy SEALs. Clearly, the SEALs embody a host of ideals, like the superior mental toughness that sports psychologist Jim Bauman spoke of. But for all of Nihon Iho's physical challenges and athleticism, it's the degree of thought and refinement. The same kind of refinement that has been applied to lacquering your bowl, for that matter, that keeps him swimming. The ideals of samurai swimming have a clear philosophical resonance today. In his book, How to Think About Exercise, the philosopher Damon Young revives the ancient idea of exercise as something that takes into account one's whole humanity, and not just what he calls the bodily machine. Young observes that the tendency to think in dualism, jocks versus nerds, sporty versus bookish, is a false divide when it comes to physical and mental exertions. Swimming's benefit, he argues, has as much to do with intellectual enhancements as it does with the achievements of the body. The ideal modern swimmer focuses on the whole experience rather than the perception of an exercise as a tune-up. Important, too, is the pride we feel in the well-exercised body. The fuller sense of self we have, Young once told an interviewer, the more responsibility we take for it. Over time, swimming has shifted from mere mechanics and survival, a military skill practiced by men, to achieve a more intangible significance, a form of recreation, a pleasure, something that can sharpen your spiritual as well as physical health. This idea of swimming for wellness, emotional resonance, whole personhood, rings true to me. The physical is intertwined with the psychological. In Japan, Sawai Atsuhiro is a best-selling author who writes about mind and body unification principles that develop ki, or life energy. He has also written about his experiences of studying to be a master in Nihon Iho. The technique that impressed him most was Shusoku Garami, which allowed